death. Mimi was the type of grandmother any kid would wish for. On our visits to her house, she would have me stand on a stool next to her so we could make donuts together. She would cuss under her breath to punctuate a story and wink at me. When my little brother and I got too rowdy, running around her house and yelling, she would brandish a knife and threaten to cut off our legs. She was funny, clever, and kind to us, both strong as a storm and as gentle as sunrise. She had the soft, wrinkled skin a grandmother is supposed to have. And though her hands were warped by arthritis, her crooked pinkies were my favorite. They were crooked not from the arthritis, but from genetics. I inherited those crooked pinkies and always felt they added something to my love for her. My mom, Mimi's daughter, had a different experience with her. She says Mimi was a very tough mother, critical and cold. Mimi never once told my mother that she loved her. I was shocked when Mom first told me this. To my siblings and me, Mimi was a bottomless well of love. When I was a kid, Mom regularly drove us the 5 hours from Nashville to Poplar Bluff, Missouri, to spend a weekend or a week with Mimi and Papa. I'm sure Mimi's help watching us kids made the long drive worth it for my mother. She raised us mostly on her own and didn't have that kind of help in Tennessee. I have memories from those visits of my mother and Mimi sitting in the kitchen, talking about adult things. This would happen every time we went. While playing or watching TV or hiding from my brother, I would walk past the two of them as they discussed the many confusing variables of adulthood. Mimi had a sharp, hard voice and spoke the way a woman would if she no longer cared to impress anyone. She always sounded self-assured, above the bullshit of the world. My mom's gentle, feminine voice on one side of the conversation, describing the unfairness of it all, and Mimi, street smart and raspy, telling her to fight and kill. I started going bald at 17, likely due to the medication I was taking for acne. It dried up my skin to help with breakouts, but its side effects were brutal. Suicidal thoughts, and my hair fell out in chunks. The shower drain got so clogged, it looked like I'd buzzed my entire head in there. I'm sure I would have gone bald no matter what. My dad is bald as hell. But at 17, that's intense. What's worse, my hair had always been thick before it started to fall out. Every time I got it cut, the barber would compliment me, amazed at how much there was. To save money, Mimi started cutting my hair whenever I went to her house. I sat in a wooden chair in her kitchen, maybe 18 years old, as Mimi snipped away the wispy strands of hair left behind from the Accutane genocide. I was self-conscious about her looking at my scalp, but she treated me like the barbers had always done. "You know, you have the most beautiful head," she said. "The shape of it. God didn't want all that hair blocking out the shape of your head. People need to see this head." She said it as if it were the most obvious thing in the world. 10 years ago, Mimi had a stroke. Suddenly, the grandmother I knew was gone. She could no longer speak or walk or wash herself. She cooed in falsetto all day. There was no melody in those vocalizations, just notes, like a broken songbird. She was a baby again. We spent the Christmas of 2010 visiting Mimi in the nursing home, with my mom bathing her and petting her and holding her hand. My sister did too. The nursing home felt like a hospital. White walls, beige doors, fluorescent lights, metal handrails running along the walls, and moaning and crying and shouting coming from behind doors. We sat in Mimi's sterile room and talked to her. She couldn't make eye contact. It felt like there was no one home to look back at you. As caretakers, my mom and sister came alive. My mother put photos and flowers all over the room. She brought Mimi's favorite things, knickknacks and treasures from her house, and lined them on the windowsill. We tried teaching her to walk again. We wrapped her arms around our necks and then lifted her up and held her on her feet as she shuffled across the floor. I held up her weight almost completely, but I could feel her weak legs pumping as she tried to stand. I knew her brain was broken and probably gone, but I told her how much I loved her right in her ear. "You're doing such a great job, Mimi." She would make a high-pitched coo and rest her warm, soft skin on my cheek. A couple days into the visit, something strange happened. As we scooted across the floor, between the endless howls of Mimi's neighbors, she got quiet for a second. And a charge went through her body, as if her muscles were working in concert again. Then she whispered, "Thank you," in my ear. Not in her baby voice, but in her real voice. I pulled back so I could look into her face, but it was too late. She became soup again, staring into space and hitting high notes. "Mom," I said, "Mimi just said thank you in my ear." "I knew it," my mom said. She walked up to Mimi and petted her. "She's in there, trying to talk to us. She's in there. Mother, we love you. We're here. We won't leave you. We'll get you walking again. We're right here." Nobody dreams of spending Christmas in a nursing home. But for 4 days, our whole family had one mission: to love and help Mimi. Looking back now, it was the best Christmas of my life. Mimi died 7 months later. By then, she and Papa had been married for 67 years. They'd slept in the same bed for nearly 7 decades. Not a king-size bed, not a queen, a double bed. When Mimi died, we didn't know what Papa would do. He was 90 years old and alone. Mimi had been all energy. She would complain about Papa loud enough for him to hear from the other room, as if she was doing a stand-up routine for him, about him. Papa moved quietly, read Popular Science magazine in his lazy boy, and watched westerns. By the time I was old enough to pay attention, I never saw Mimi and Papa engage each other. I mean, really look at each other. They made little jokes that got the other one to chuckle, fart jokes or half-hearted threats of divorce. They'd talk about gas prices and my Aunt Vicky and their 2 little yipping dogs. Their relationship wasn't kisses and holding hands. Maybe that's how they were for the first 40 years. But by now, it was settled coexistence. 2 humans who became 1 comfortable thing, sitting beside each other in recliners watching Barbara Walters. They were as joined as the land and sky. And now, Mimi was gone. My mom hired a caretaker to move in and help Papa around the house, but I wondered how long he would survive without his wife. In the end, he made it 2 years. A brain tumor grew in the darkness of his skull, unknown to anyone, until one day I got a call from my mother saying Papa was at the hospital for emergency surgery. They soon learned it was inoperable. The next day, he was in a coma. Mom said the doctors would try to keep him on life support long enough for the family to say goodbye. But it was likely he would die any day, any minute. When we talked, I was in Washington, D.C., about to host a youth conference for the nonprofit where I worked. 4,000 people were going to attend. I was one of the MCs. I debated with myself and floated the idea of leaving. My coworkers were sympathetic. They told me I could leave if I wanted to, but I knew they didn't want me to. And in some buried way, I didn't want to leave either. I have always been averse to extreme, awkward emotions, to death and sadness. I guess we all are. I do not rush in to help. I hide in my busyness. To be brutally honest, I think I hoped Papa would die and I would miss the drama of it all and then get there for the funeral. I didn't think this with clear thoughts. I just told myself, "I can't miss this conference. I'm the MC. These kids are expecting me." I called my mom and told her I couldn't skip the conference. "I am one of the faces of the whole thing," I said. She understood. "Papa knows you love him. The funeral will be next week, so just come straight here when you're done." The conference was in 3 days. I got an update on Papa every day. He was hanging on. He saw my brother, my sister, his two daughters, his nieces and nephews. When I say he saw them, it was more that they came by and held his hand and said goodbye. In that hospital bed, he was silent and still. The doctor said there was nothing going on in his head, that the tumor had killed his brain. They moved him out of the hospital and into hospice care in his home. The conference came and went. On Sunday afternoon, I went to the airport to fly to St. Louis, rent a car, and drive the rest of the 2 hours from there. I called my mom on the way to Poplar Bluff. "The doctors are amazed that he's hung on this long," she said. "I think he's waiting on you, Jed. You're the only one that hasn't said goodbye." As I drove through the dark Missouri countryside, I wondered how Papa would look when I saw him. Would he be swollen or green, or just asleep? I got there around midnight. Mom came and met me on the front porch. She looked ecstatic. "Almost 30 minutes ago, he started shaking and convulsing," she said. "He hasn't moved an inch in days. His spirit knew you were coming." I walked into the house and saw my grandfather. A hospital bed had been moved into the living room in the exact place where his lazy boy had been for decades. Papa was in his spot. Only his hand was wiggling. My mom was beaming. "He's so happy you're here. He waited for you, Jed." The hospice nurse was standing beside him. "You can hold his hand. Talk to him. It's fine. This is special. He hasn't moved in days," she said. I walked towards him, or floated, really. It felt surreal. I took Papa's hand, and he stopped shaking. By that point, I knew his brain was mush. I believed the doctors who read the charts and saw that there was nothing inside. But as I held his warm, strong hands, hands that had always seemed made of wood, I remembered Mimi's thank you and wondered if something was still in there. I mean, he was shaking for me, right? "I love you, Papa," I said. "You set such a good example of what a man should be. Noble, kind, a good husband, wise, hardworking. I'm so honored to be your grandson. I love you." That's all I had. He had been such a quiet man. I hardly knew him in the way I know most people, but I did love him. He was less a string of words than a presence, a sturdiness, an eternal calm present. I looked to my mom, gave a flat-lipped smile, and nodded. She took his other hand and leaned over him. "Okay, Daddy. Everyone's come and said their goodbyes. You can go now. You can go be with Mimi. We love you so very much." He lay there, perfectly still with the oxygen tube in his nose, his eyes closed. I wondered if he heard anything. I assumed he did not. But I believe in symbolism, ritual, and what it meant to us to say goodbye, to feel the blood in his still warm hands, to get our peace for us. I went to the guest bedroom and set my bag down. That night, Mom would sleep in the bedroom where Mimi and Papa had slept for decades. The hospice nurse would stay with Papa in the living room, sleep on the couch, I assumed. I brushed my teeth and crawled under the covers. But as I leaned to turn off the lamp and sleep, the door opened. It was Mom. "Jed, he really did wait for you. He's gone. The nurse just told me." I leapt up and followed her into the living room. Papa was dead. "He was waiting for you," Mom repeated. "He's with Mimi now." We went into the kitchen with the hospice nurse. My mom made tea. "Does this happen a lot?" I asked the nurse. "It does. Often the person who is unconscious or seems to be will wait for someone specific. I've even seen them wait for someone to leave the room, someone they don't like." "I thought the doctor said he was brain dead," I said. "It's very hard to know what's going on in there," the nurse said. But my mom, after all she'd seen that week, wasn't in doubt. "His soul was still in there," she said. Do you know the names of your great-grandparents? What about your great-greats? What were their names? What did they do for work? I bet many of you don't. That's only 4 generations away, 100 years ago. You are their legacy. Their children's 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 children. And you don't even know them. What does it mean to disappear? Someday, you will be forgotten too. There is an app called WeCroak that reminds you 5 times a day that you will die. It sends you a random push notification with a quote like, "Death is only the end if you assume the story is about you." Or, "People are born soft and weak. They die hard and stiff." The intent is to promote contemplation and prioritization of time. If you are reminded that you will die, perhaps you won't stress so much when you can't find a parking spot, or when Jessica doesn't return your text. My friend Joey uses the app and says he likes it. I do not use it. I am afraid it would put too much dread on me, inject too much intensity into moments that deserve to be silly. Sometimes I want to be annoyed at simple things. But I do think it's important to do just what that app does, to remind yourself that you will die, and because of that absolute fact, some things matter more than others. I say absolute fact, but I know that scientists and billionaires in Silicon Valley are, as I read, trying to solve the problem of aging. It is believed that we age because of something called the Hayflick limit. Human cells stop dividing properly, that is, copying themselves exactly, after around 50 divisions. After that magical number, small bits of DNA are lost when your body replaces its cells. This is aging. Some cells do not do this. The Hayflick limit is not universal. It is programmed in there for some reason, and scientists want to turn it off, or maybe even reverse its effects. At some point, aging might become something that happens only to the poor. What could result is a very strange dystopia. Without the certainty of aging and death, death would come only by mistake or boredom. The rich would take far fewer risks. You wouldn't have to die of old age, but you could still die in a plane crash or burn to ash in a house fire or fall off a cliff. And then we might observe the existential dread that comes from living 900 years and becoming bored, literally, to death. Even then, I think that famous statement from Steve Jobs would apply. Quote, "Remembering that you are going to die is the best way I know to avoid the trap of thinking you have something to lose. You are already naked. There is no reason not to follow your heart." End quote. Whether death is inevitable or elective or feared, it will retain its true power. Death is what gives life meaning. The act of not being alive makes being alive special. There is no light without darkness. There is no waking without sleep. Maybe that weird app is onto something. I follow a very disturbing account on Instagram. It's called Nature is Metal. It is simply photos and videos of animals brutalizing each other. A snake swallowing another snake. A praying mantis catching a hummingbird and eating it alive. A baby gazelle stooping down to drink from brown water. And the water becomes the mouth of a 14-foot crocodile. The captions highlight the meaninglessness of death in the animal kingdom, the absolute vacuum of dignity. Quote, "Komodo dragon slamming a monkey down the yapper." Or, "Yoink, python ambushes a juvenile deer at the local watering hole." Why do I follow it? Because I have a young boy's morbid fascination with death and gore, and because there is something less repugnant about violence between animals. The morality is taken out. They were designed to do this. The spider evolved fangs to tear into a bug's beautiful shell and kill it. That's nature doing its thing. And it isn't always for food. In one video, I watched a hippopotamus drown a gazelle for no reason. The crocodiles are my favorite to watch. They elicit the same horror in me as great white sharks, killing machines so far removed from us that we see no mind working in their eyes. No language or emotion, just a blackness that will kill you. A crocodile comes from the water just like a shark, but his water is brown. You can't see 1 inch through it. He moves invisibly and takes brutal advantage of an animal's most basic need, drinking water. One post shows a zebra surrounded by crocodiles after a fight. They are all in the water, the zebra's nearly dead body laid across the backs of a few crocs. The zebra is moving only slightly, clearly tired from the struggle. As you look, you see that the zebra's nose and mouth have been ripped off. The top half of its head is normal zebra, black and white stripes, down to its eyes. But just below the eyes, a few inches down, the bottom half is gone. All that is left is pink flesh and white skull. A bit of flesh from its cheek is pulled taut in a croc's mouth, and the croc is trying to rip it away. In that video, the crocodiles do not seem hurried or even very interested. They move slowly while the zebra rests on them and weakly pulses, making small objections to being eaten. One crocodile lumbers up and tries to bite the zebra's large rump, but can't get his mouth around. The caption reads, "Welcome to hell. Nature doesn't give a flying fuck about your feelings." As a kid in church, I was taught that the Garden of Eden was a real place. It had no death. Lions lay with lambs. Everything lived in peace and lived forever. It was the sin of Eve and then Adam that brought death to all. This story was always hard for me. If the lion lays down with the lamb instead of killing it, what will his cubs eat? Grass? With those huge sharp teeth? Some Christian writers and teachers, including C.S. Lewis, have believed the story was metaphor, that evolution was real and that the story of Adam and Eve was a hypersimplified story given to us by God to convey his creative glory. That felt right to me. But others, like my pastor in college, believed that the story was not a metaphor. It was exactly true. That pastor was perhaps the only true genius I've ever met. He had a photographic memory, and his cohesive comprehension of the Bible was a supernova to behold. He could sew dozens of passages together into a sermon, having us flip from Genesis to Jeremiah to Revelation without ever looking at his notes. Any question you asked, he could answer with a waterfall of Bible verses. They came to him from the top of his head like flits of lightning. People asked about heaven and hell, about divorce, about specific verses that confused them. One morning, after the church's sunrise Bible study, I asked, "If there was no death before the fall, then why do so many animals have specific features designed for death, like a snake's fangs, or a scorpion's tail, or a spider's web? What did these animals look like in Eden without these important parts of them?" The genius pastor didn't hesitate. "All of creation was distorted at the moment of the fall," he said. "Death came not just for Adam and Eve, but for all the world. So in that moment, the brutality of killing came to the animal kingdom." So they, like, morphed? We don't know exactly. It could have happened in an instant. God could change all of creation in the blink of an eye and we wouldn't know. But maybe a morphing, yes. Wow, a cuddly spider morphing into a murder machine before our eyes. This answer ignited a curiosity in me. I didn't think of it like that. And yet I couldn't buy it. It's just too forced. Reverse engineered to make the Bible story work. I've always found the explanation, "with God all things are possible," to be annoying. It shuts down thinking, which is perhaps the point. Besides, the most interesting parts of these animals are the parts that kill. The brilliant stripes of a tiger are there so it can hide when it hunts. Were they an afterthought of the fall? The neon colors of the poison dart frog are a warning. If you eat it, you will die. The streamline of a shark, the speed of the falcon, the silent glide of an owl's wing, the deadly talons of the eagle. Did eagles have duck feet in Eden? What are we to make of all this killing? What makes a man evil and a hippopotamus innocent? Is it the soul, free will, consciousness? The absence of morality in nature is strange. Big cats bite the necks of their victims, suffocating them before they eat them. This feels humane in a way, but biologists believe it's simply an adaptation to protect the cats. A flailing animal could kick you in the face. A dead one is easier to shred. My family's cat used to leave us presents at the back door. I came home from school one day to find a living chipmunk with his belly split open and his intestines dragging behind him as he slowly tried to crawl off the porch. My cat sat a few feet away, watching, blank-faced, proud. Humans, at least in theory, are held to a higher standard. If we torture a dog, that is wrong. But if an orca flips a seal pup into the sky, we see it as the whale's hunting instinct blending with its instinct to play. When I look closer at us, though, at human behavior, it feels like we aren't so different from that orca. If I stab you, I am a bad man. But if I have a blood clot in my brain that drives me mad, and I am incapacitated by the seizure of my mind, did I do the stabbing, or was it the blood clot's fault? If I am having a proper muscle spasm and stab you with a kitchen knife in my hand, you probably won't hold that against me. Everything, when inspected closely enough, seems inevitable, somehow cleansed of moral failure. I've noticed that most of the movies I grew up with had starkly contrasted villains and heroes. The bad guys were cartoonishly evil, absent of any complexity. The shark in Jaws, Saruman, Voldemort, Ursula, Darth Vader. Then the anti-hero emerged. The Star Wars prequels tried to explain the rise of Vader, and Maleficent, the evil witch from Sleeping Beauty, was humanized. Walter White started as a bumbling science teacher, and we watched as his ego turned him into a monster. The Joker became a sad child of neglect and mental illness. These stories attempt to show that every villain has a backstory, something that made them the way they are. In other words, they blur the source of evil, which we often assume is the will of a human soul. They give our bad deeds a spot in the chain of events of reality, an ultimate cause of some twist in the past, a bad mother, an early rejection. They engender a sense of empathy for the villain, the feeling that they'd been wronged, made into monsters by someone or society. What makes these stories more tragic is that the injury doesn't have to be the result of choice. There isn't always a senior villain who made the junior villain. There isn't always a malignant cause. How often have I caught feelings for someone who liked me only as a friend? I'll read their kindness as flirting, and then rage at them for not texting me back later that night. But it wasn't their fault. It was a tango of my leaping assumptions and perhaps their overly compliant kindness, the lingered hand on my shoulder, or even their benign enjoyment of flirtatious energy that sent me whirling. Where is the evil there? Where is the will? These little moments feel like micro-metaphors for the causes of bigger problems. When brothers hurt each other's feelings, their pride can keep them from apologizing or even speaking to each other for decades. Now take these a few steps up, to the largeness of misunderstandings between groups, and you get disagreements between companies, between church denominations and ethnic groups, hurt feelings and pride, miscommunications, small cuts going unhealed until they fester into wounds, and small lies metastasizing into myths, stories, and legends, good guys and bad guys, war, genocide, and racism. Some people are rotten to the core, sociopaths and violent dictators, but I think they are far more rare than we assume. Most of the tragedy in human society stems from these smaller rippling hurts, small and big distrusts compounding and mixing with human desires, and the tension caused by the fact that different people want different things. I can't find where evil comes from. If it's from the devil, then why are we held responsible? At the shallowest level, we hold people responsible. Adolf is evil. So is the rapist. They don't get a backstory. Is George W. Bush evil? Many Iraqis must think so. Millions of Americans would say he is not. Who gets to say? When the hurricane comes and rips a tree from the soil, does the tree call the wind and rain evil? How would I define evil? That which is not of God? That which is against life? I don't know. But it feels rooted in death, in the fear of death, in the fear of those who cause death. We cling to life so tightly, don't we? Take a walk through a beautiful forest and ask the choking kudzu if it is evil. Ask the spider waiting for a moth. Ask the bluebird with a grasshopper in its pretty little beak. Ask the frenzy of death all around you. The soul. I've never had a spiritual experience, never heard the voice of God or felt the tangible presence of the divine. There was a time when I really wanted to speak in tongues, and so I forced myself to do it while I prayed alone, hunched over on my knees in my closet. I've never been good at asking for things, especially from God. Usually, I just prayed gratitude. But when someone told me there was a difference between praying in tongues and a prayer language, more personal meditation than the foreign language miraculously spoken in church, I was intrigued. So I just started making sounds. Sha-na-na-na-na-ra-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. And kept going until it felt less willed than inevitable, flowing out of me like a mantra. My mind had been freed from thought, and my tongue was released to do whatever it wanted to. For a few moments, I felt separate from the faking, like I was doing something holy, talking with God. Who knows? I don't know what to make of the spiritual world. I don't know if I believe in it at all. But it is the most profound part of many people's lives. Millions of people, maybe the majority of people on the planet, would say it's the most important thing that matters. And it is the foundation of the family I grew up in. The fact that we are not mere matter, but souls. As the saying goes, you do not have a soul, you are a soul, you have a body. This may be true. Matter is neither created nor destroyed. Upon death, we are rearranged into something else. And anyone alive can feel a current of something flowing through them. I have never died, so I don't know what happens, if anything. But I have believed in my soul and worried that it would end up in hell. I have believed that God is everywhere and animated our bodies with spirits. I have hoped that Mimi's spirit is watching over me. I often still do. When I was 9 and my little brother was 7, our family took a road trip from Nashville to Canada. It was a long drive with stops in Missouri, Kansas, South Dakota, North Dakota, Montana, and Alberta. My stepdad, Mike, drove a blue GM Yukon pulling a 30-foot camper, and my mom sat with him in the front. In the back seat, my sister sat against the window doing something I can't remember, while my brother and I bickered and teased each other for thousands of miles. I would covertly tickle him, and he would flail and shout, "Jed won't leave me alone!" By the time my mom spun around, I would be there, book in my hands, sitting perfectly still. "I'm not even touching you," I'd say, the devil in my heart. Sometimes I won. My mom would say, "Luke, calm down and stop." And Luke, incensed, would look at me in shock. I'd smile at him like Rasputin. At one point, we were driving through some flat stretch of nothing, and Luke said, "I really have to poop." We were miles away from any gas station or exit. I saw this as the perfect opportunity to tickle him. I guess I didn't project what success would look like. I just knew it would make him miserable. When I tickled him, he screamed, and I heard a fart. A lumpy fart, with the resonance of surround sound. Then, the car smelled like, well, human shit. a rank invasion that left every person in the car screaming. Mike quickly pulled over. Luke's underwear was removed and thrown into a field. I received a proper scolding. And as we drove away, Luke said, "I told you to stop," over and over. A few days into the trip, we stopped in Rapid City, South Dakota. The campground was big, with RVs and campers and cars parked next to tents. There were sewer hookups and decent showers and a crusty pool. After pulling in late in the afternoon, we walked out the front entrance to eat at the diner down the block. Then we played cards in the RV and went to sleep. Tomorrow, we would get up early to drive to Mount Rushmore. The camper had two bunk beds in the back, next to the master bedroom, which was sectioned off by a curtain. The table in the kitchen area collapsed into a bed. Luke and I slept in different bunks, with me on top and him on the bottom. Mom and Mike were in the big bed, and my sister Rebecca was on the table bed by the door. Both of my siblings were known sleepwalkers. I'd heard stories of my sister crawling around the house on all fours, screaming at the top of her lungs. My brother wasn't that dramatic. He would just walk around the house like a lazy ghost, silent, emotionless. But I guess they had never sleepwalked away from home, and it wasn't a common enough occurrence for Mom and Mike to worry about it. It happened maybe 2 times a year. It never crossed anyone's mind that they could walk out of our RV and get lost in the wilderness. Apparently, at some point that night, Luke got up, walked over to the door with the soft feet of a cat, fumbled it open in silence, and went outside. To do this in a trailer without waking anyone up would have been impossible. We were all within mere feet of one another. But he did it, moving like a silky ninja in his unconscious state. We don't know at what point in the night he did this. We knew it happened only because there came a knock at the door around 4 a.m. It was pitch black outside. A knock on the camper door at that hour is quite jarring. We woke up confused. Mike wrenched himself from the bed, put on a t-shirt to accompany his boxers, and walked to the door. He was a stern man with a deep baritone, the voice a water buffalo would have if it spoke English. "Hello," he said as he leaned to the door with a bothered brow. "Hello," a kind male voice answered from the other side of the door. "I think I may have something that belongs to you." The door swung open. "Luke," Mike said. I couldn't see the other man. I only saw Mike's outline in the doorway. "I had gone to bed when I heard a child crying," the man said. "When I looked outside, there was this little red-headed boy wandering around. He said his name was Luke, and I asked where he was from, and he said he was either from Missouri or Tennessee. He wasn't sure. I've been searching a half hour for campers from the South." "Wow, well, thank you very much," Mike said. His bullish tone softened. "I guess we'll lock the door." "That's a good idea," the man said through a smile big enough to hear. "Well, I'll let you all get some rest. Luke, it was nice to meet you. You stay inside now, okay?" "Thank you very much," Mike repeated in an awkwardly formal manner, confused by the whole episode. From my bed, I heard the gravel crunch as the man walked away. Luke was quiet. He stepped into the trailer, and Mike locked the door and led him to his bed. I fell asleep to the muffled mumblings of my mother and Mike coming from the back. The next morning, Mike and my mom were out the door at dawn. They had gone to the front desk to find the man and thank him. But when Mike described the guy to the person behind the counter, it didn't ring a bell. They searched all morning, went camper by camper. There was no sign of him ever having stayed there. Mom and Mike were flummoxed, wondering if they'd imagined the whole thing. "Jed, did you wake up and see that man who brought Luke back last night?" Mike asked when they returned. "I didn't see him, but I heard him talk." Mike turned to my mom. "See, at least we know it really happened." As we drove toward Canada, my mom said, "What if that man was a real angel, sent by God to protect Luke? He could have walked into traffic or been kidnapped. I bet he was an angel." A few months ago, someone asked, So, are you still a Christian? I said yes, but that word means something different to me than it did 10 years ago. What have I shed? What have I changed? For one, I no longer crave certainty. The gatekeeping suspicion, are you one of us or not, is not on my breath. I do not worship the Bible. I see it as a brilliant, messy roadmap, humanity's search for God. I do not care what name you give to Jesus. I do not care what language you put to the ever-flowing work of God. I tried all that. I shoved God and Jesus into this tiny members-only club. And boy, the two of them rattled that cage. They broke apart these trembling communities through bickering and atrophy and betrayal. God kept saying, "Why do you labor to defend me? Don't you see I need no protection? I fear no blasphemy. I fear no deception. What is it that you think you're protecting?" God mocks the teachers who assume he quit speaking 2,000 years ago, the ones who scrape their knees as they crawl, begging to follow rules and laws, begging to be told how to live, and ignoring God's commission to rise, look him in the eye, and accept the invitation to astonishment. But as I talk about it more, the language loses its shape. I start speaking in generalities. The metaphors are as close as I can get. I am a Christian. I keep this language because it gives credit where credit is due. It's where I come from. I was raised in a firm and sturdy belief, but I did not stay there. I do not worship the nest in which I hatched. It was there I was fed and grew my wings, but I am a bird. "Come and see the sky," I heard, long before I knew that's what I was hearing. How could the truth of God be hidden? Or, to say it differently, why would the spiritually urgent be kept from us? I don't know how I ever rationalized the confusing commission of Paul. Evangelize the world, save them from hell. Of course, those who never hear the gospel won't go to hell, those uncontacted tribes in Brazil. But you should still go there and share the good news. What? Then why would I go? Why would I give someone the option to love Jesus just to risk them going to hell? If I never gave them the option, they'd be good, right? This strange equation, that salvation lies in special knowledge, in a special story, really ate at me. The full truth of the universe must be present on the back of a stupid bug on the sidewalk or not exist at all. I've spent so many years feverishly buying books looking for the right teaching, the truest revelation. Maybe C.S. Lewis knows, maybe Alan Watts, maybe Carl Sagan. I thought that if I didn't study hard enough, look hard enough, the truth would turn away from me. Then it unraveled. God may have hid secret messages, love notes, deep in the trillionth digit of pi. He may have made the universe endlessly interesting. He may have made our souls as deep can go. But he wouldn't withhold salvation. He wouldn't withhold his love behind an unfair game we were born to lose. I realized, put down the books for a minute and behold the ant tickling your leg. It is enough. You belong. Relax. Christians often ask one another, "How's your relationship with God?" I used to hear it all the time, from one Bible study to the next. I used to ask it a lot, too. People don't ask me that anymore. Most Christians know I'm not exactly one of them. But I'll answer it as if I were. I've never felt closer to God. I've never felt so real, so true. I don't lie to God anymore. I don't use faith as a social scorecard. I know you want me to say something different, something clearer, something more certain, but I'd rather tell the truth. When I used to ask people that question, I was asking something different. I see this only now. I was probing them to see if they were the same kind of Christian as me, to size them up, to see if they were saved, in the club. I was asking them to see if I was better or worse. I secretly hoped they were praying less than me, going to church less than me. In my 20s, I started to see the rot in my soul. This performative faith that had so much less to do with God and the truth than comfort and being right. I was never afraid of God. I was afraid of my community, of loneliness, of abandonment. I love God, whatever that means. I love you, whatever that means. I love my odd life, and I feel what it means more and more every day. I hope you don't mind me showing my cards the way I do. I've never enjoyed playing to win. There is a word in Japanese that has no translation in English, yugen. It is the feeling of the mysterious bigness of the universe, the sad beauty of the pain of living. The 14th century playwright Zayami Motokiyo compared it to wandering in a huge forest without thought of return. The term originated in Chinese philosophy, where it meant dim or deep. As it integrated into Japanese aesthetic poetry, it took on the meaning of that which cannot be said. It alludes not to another world, but to the unsayable, pulsing meaning of this one. This is the core of my religious experience, the unsayable, the abstract weight of meaning that lands on us like beauty. The whole world can fall apart. Your parents can die, your husband can stop loving you, and all manner of things can go wrong. What we expect from life goes unfulfilled and often. But even in the rubble of the worst chaos, if you manage to hang on, there will be a lull in the hell around you, a clear sky and maybe a sunset. If you are given 1 minute to catch your breath, you might think, "The sky is beautiful." You may feel bad for thinking this when misery has become your reason, when anger at God has become your calling. But you can't help it. Even fire can be beautiful. And rainbows show up in the middle of war. When this happens, the thought that it all might just mean something creeps back in. Even if it's a delusion, it creeps back in. Growing up, we're taught a series of myths. We reject the myths as we age and decide what we really believe. But sometimes we discover the myths later, with the benefit of new wisdom. The story of Adam and Eve really bugged me. What kind of all-knowing creator would set us up for failure? Is the knowledge of good and evil really that bad? As I grew up, my belief in that story didn't last. It didn't make sense. It was too simple, too human. Seeing the world as it is today, with billions of humans trying to navigate more information than our monkey brains can process, I look at the story differently. At one time, we lived in the balance of nature. We did that for a very long time. But knowledge came around, and we conquered the world with it. We didn't eat from the tree of the wisdom of the balance of life. It was the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. The tree taught us things like this or that, a false binary that has poisoned the world, right or wrong, profitable or worthless, growth or death, bits of incomplete information, rumors and clickbait, confirmation bias, the wolf of emotion in the clothes of reason. The garden was protecting us from knowledge, and now we worship knowledge above all. That which can be destroyed by the truth should be. P.C. Hodgel. How liberating. That is where my allegiance lies, the truth, and in the utility of a course correction. If I feel in my heart something is right, I will move in the direction of the rightness. And if I find that I was wrong all along, I will adjust. If I burn my hands, I will pull away. If you couldn't speak or write, what would your life say? What would those around you say you believe? I've spent most of my life surrounded by born-again Christians. They believe that the Son of God died to save them from their sins, and that this same Messiah walked around the Middle East telling people to denounce material wealth, serve the widows and the poor, pick up their cross, and follow him. But the Christians from my upbringing, myself included, weren't much different from everyone else. Maybe we didn't have sex before marriage. Maybe we went to church or Bible study to see our friends. But none of us were giving our coats away or housing widows and refugees. I mean, maybe we donated to Christian organizations that did work like that. Maybe we gave money to a homeless guy or even made sandwiches once a year to pass out. We certainly didn't heed Jesus' warnings about wealth. We loved wealth. We were American, goddammit. Actions are the real signifiers of internal conviction. Imagine if you couldn't tell people what you stood for. Instead, they would look back at the last year of your life, stripped of words, and report back what they saw. Who would you be? Someone who cares about racial justice, equality, the environment? What did you do this year with your time? What if they looked only at where you spent your money? People would think my religion is eating out. The Pennsylvania Constitution has a clause that requires office holders to believe in a supreme being and an afterlife based on reward and punishment. 8 states still have these clauses. The Supreme Court ruled them unenforceable in 1961, but they are still there, reminders of what once was. Some of these clauses made Protestant belief the requirement, as a way to exclude Catholics and Jews from office. Others were safeguards against dangerous atheists. But another reason for these clauses was the concept of an omnipotent watcher. You might lie and trick all those around you, people believed, but God is watching. You cannot deceive God. This felt especially important with police officers, politicians, and judges. These tests are rightly gone. I don't want one denomination or religion to dominate others. But I wonder what integrity looks like without belief in a watcher on high. It makes sense to me that a person in power should fear the judgment of their soul. That corruption and duplicity will not stand. But these tests never really worked in the first place. Judges and officers and priests have been abusing power from the very beginning. Torture and murder during the Inquisition, molestation and cover-ups in last week's New York Times. These things are so common, they are almost a feature of organized religion. But I do believe that integrity in the smallest things has some kind of cosmic dividend, that the measure of good character is how you treat people who can do nothing for you. Here's a dumb but relevant story. More than once, I've sneezed in my hands and wiped them on the seat of a taxi. It wasn't until now, as I sit down to think about this, that I ever felt bad for doing it. Something subconscious directed me to wipe my fucking snot on a stranger's car, a car that they personally own, simply because they'll probably never see it and definitely never know it was me. My lizard brain took the opportunity for granted. It said, "No one is watching, therefore there is no consequence." I don't believe in a God who keeps tallies, but I do believe that God is watching, whatever that means. When I act selfishly to the secret detriment of another, the universe listens and sends rotten ripples into the whatever. I am not innocent of those actions, even if it simply means that they accrue in my heart until I feel like a bad person, a coward, and a phony. This belief has consequences. When you decide that you are beyond repair, you acquiesce to the cycle of pain. You hurt others and throw up your hands and say, "What can you expect? This is what I am." Who we believe ourselves to be is who we become. Be the person you needed when you were younger. I saw this quote attributed to Banksy, but I don't know who really said it. It seems too cheesy for Banksy, even if it's true. As a teenager, I needed someone who loved God and science, who wasn't so certain about things that felt uncertain to me, who didn't think people were just straight or gay or conservative or liberal or right or wrong, but somewhere on a gray scale of self-discovery, who didn't answer questions with, "Well, that's what the Bible says," who knew that a good person could disagree with other good people, who didn't fear their own mind, who saw the big picture and said, "Isn't it messy and beautiful?" Of course, if I knew what to look for, I would have realized those people had been around me all along. But I needed someone who looked like me, talked like me, translated the world in a way I understood. That's the fresh commission on every human life. There is no one exactly like you. And yet there are many who are similar to you and have never felt seen or understood. You never know who is watching and who needs you to express it all. How's that for some cheese? The view from my chair in the living room. The crappy little table I bought online. My $2 succulents. My hummingbird feeder. I stare at them like I would a sleeping lover, heartwarmed that they are unaware of their beauty. How miraculous to be conscious, to be the result of random molecules procreating for billions of years, waking up into selfhood and belief. Sometimes I feel like we don't belong here, like we screw everything up on this planet as if we're an invasive species. But this planet made us, or perhaps some kind of god or overmind made us, to bring it pleasure or company. It's just all such a marvel. I am a conscious bag of atoms, many of which were in the bodies of dinosaurs, and now they bounce around in me. I was either created with meaning, or I wasn't, and find meaning everywhere anyway. Imagine if humans are just random molecules, and yet we write novels. We, meaningless matter, write stories about fictional meaningless matter to make ourselves feel things, even sadness. Why am I astonished? This is the one and only world any of us know. Why should we find it strange? And yet we do. A parable. 1,000 years ago, God appeared to a boy in the desert and gave him a piece of glass. God said, "You can hold this glass in your hand and see the whole world. Whatever you want to know, it is in there." The boy said, "But how? This piece of glass is so small. How can I know the world?" God said, "You will know it like drops of water, one drop at a time. You will collect puddles of the world, and you will think you know it. But you will not. You cannot know the wholeness of the ocean by looking at its drops. You will fight your brother because his drops are different than yours. You will imagine different holes. You will blame the tide on the tide pools. You will believe driftwood is bones." The boy replied, "But I want to know as much as I can." God said, "I know, son. You will love the glass, and you will stare into it with love in your mind. You will stop seeing and smelling the bigness of the world around your body. You will be drunk with obsession for tiny keyholes into every other place but your own." The boy said, "Then why would you give me this? Why would I want bits of information if you tell me they will betray the real whole?" God said, "You cannot possibly understand now. Did Judas understand his role in the story of everything? The world is healed by mistakes." Often, when I am trying to write about my life, my experience feels so unique that it cannot be spoken about with clarity. It can only be felt. But when I talk about it, almost every time, I find friends leaning in and saying, "Me too." My Christian friends say, "Me too." My Jewish and Muslim friends say, "Me too." My faithless friends say, "Tell me more." The music we make can be transposed into many keys. Tradition versus expression, family and freedom, to stay or to go, to love your captors, to hurt the ones you love by prioritizing survival over comfort, to change so drastically that your prior self feels like a completely different person. I miss church, the songs and seeing friends and lunch after service, sitting outside on a Sunday afternoon. I travel too much these days to have a dependable routine, so I rarely get to go. But when the mysterious world hides its beauty from me, and I feel only chaos and hurt, I miss the old certainty I had among the pews, of worrying about which Christian CD was okay to listen to, which book was biblical enough, which candidate was pro-life enough to get my vote. I miss walking down the street, knowing I was eternal and my soul was safe. nowhere seeing the disconnect between my comfort in the love of Jesus and the thought of billions burning for eternity all around me. If I'd ever really believed it, I think I'd have been weeping and gnashing my teeth in the streets to save just one more soul. But I liked being told what to believe. I think most people do. It's hard to think for yourself, so much responsibility. I liked getting caught up in the momentum of a pastor who believed in his words. There was a thrill to feeling God's watchful and angry eye. Now I feel God's all-embracing patience, which feels cosmically true, but less safe. An angry father is at least paying attention, caring what I do. A distant sage allows me to stumble and then asks me to learn. While walking through the woods as a kid, I would bust and push my way through thickets and cut my arms and squint my eyes. And then I would find a deer trail, a path well worn by generations of deer. Over time, they walked and found the best way through, and by using it often, they kept it smooth and free from overgrowth. The deer had no survey men, no instruments or contractors. All they had were the deer before them. I spent my 20s preaching, the classic folly of the young. I'm calmer now, more confident that the truth of the universe is fearless and kind, patient, and hidden in plain sight. And now that I'm through the thicket, I'm finding a well-worn path, full of 10-point bucks and regal does with quiet steps. Driving along the beach in Big Sur, I couldn't see 15 feet in front of me. The fog was a blindfold, cold and gray-white, covering the Pacific Coast Highway and the places where the mountains hit the sea. But I turned off the road, away from the ocean, and went up the steep switchbacks. I climbed up and found that the blindness went only so high. Above the fog, it was as clear as a desert sky, and there she was, the sun, still shining. The fog that had covered me looked different from above. What was blinding then now showed itself as an endless rolling blanket, soft and shiny in the sun. It's nice to imagine how God would see all this muck and confusion of human society. It calms me down. Imagine being a baby in your mother's womb and having consciousness. You have arms and legs and lungs and eyes and a mouth, but are completely flabbergasted as to why. All you've ever done is float in that warm juice. You think your body's features are useless, a waste. Life is comfortable and cozy in your cocoon. You can't imagine anything better than your current life, and you have no idea that it will ever change. But your strange body, equipped with so many useless tools, nags you. You flip and kick, testing them out. And you make a million guesses, probably all wrong. Then one day, your whole life changes. A scary transition happens. You're moved into a strange world where you feel helpless and terrible. Now the body you had all along becomes profoundly useful. Your lungs fill with this mysterious thing called air. This analogy was given to me by a pastor years ago. Even if we don't know what's coming, the analogy says, we were made for it. He was talking about heaven, but I think the description works for more than that. I think it works for life. I know so many people who went through confusing labyrinths before arriving at contentment and joy and a career they love. In their 20s or 30s, they worked random jobs where they felt useless and wondered what it all meant. They couldn't have known that working this odd job or that would be the thing that gave them the idea to start their own thing. Going to that random city was how they met their wife. They didn't know that the angst of discontent was prepping them for destiny. Sometimes I think we're still in the womb, kicking at the walls, feeling too big for our cocoon, and thinking nothing will ever change. This is Jedediah Jenkins. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Like Streams to the Ocean, Notes on Ego, Love, and the Things That Make Us Who We Are. This program was directed by Sam Popkin. Executive producer, Laura Wilson. Edited by Matthew Green. Text copyright 2020 by Jedediah Jenkins. Production copyright 2020, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.